This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 28th. I'm Laura Flanders. Coming up, Israeli troops invade and reoccupy a Palestinian town. Slobodan Milosevic prepares for his next appearance at The Hague. A public comment period on roadless areas seems designed to keep comments down. And Indians fight a U.S. patent on rice. First, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Bush administration may not send a high-level delegation to the UN General Assembly session on the child next month. State Department officials said negotiations are continuing in New York over the agenda, but the president wants to make sure the declaration has no references to abortion services or language that would give children rights above those of their parents. This on the heels of the U.S. refusal to send an official delegation to the U.N. Conference on Racism this week in Durban, South Africa. But as Deepa Fernandez reports from Durban, the U.S. is well represented, and many are wondering why the media is so concerned about the level of U.S. participation at the conference when there are other more pressing issues to consider, like the ones actually being discussed at the NGO meetings.
No one really knows what's going to happen. What we do know is that the big bullies, heavy hitters like the United States, are not going to allow any kind of discussion of the real racism that's happening within their country to actually come out. So for most people out here, they're not even focusing on the official United Nations conference, because to them it's already passed out of the realm of folks will actually do something about it.
That was Deepa Fernandez in Durban. The Peruvian Congress says former President Alberto Fujimori, now in exile in Japan, can be tried for crimes against humanity. Tatiana Harrison reports from Lima, Peru.
In a unanimous vote, the Congress lifted the ex-president's constitutional immunity and gave a go-ahead to prosecutors to charge Alberto Fujimori with crimes against humanity. Prosecutors have 5 days to file charges of homicide and forced disappearance for two massacres committed in the early 90s by paramilitary death squads, in which 25 people died. Although the prosecutors hope to force Japan to extradite Fujimori or try him in an international tribunal, legal experts doubt Japan will buy the evidence against him. Fujimori, via a website he recently set up, ridiculed the Congress's charges that he systematically violated human rights to fight insurgent groups. In his message to the Peruvian people, he dismissed the charges as political persecution. Tatiana Harrison in Lima, Peru, for Free Speech Radio News.
Activists presented their demands to the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund at a press conference today, highlighting why they think the organizations are not democratic and do cause global suffering. Zach Badorf reports from D.C.
The four goals demanded that the World Bank IMF open all meetings to the media and the public, cancel all impoverished country debt, and all policies that hinder people's access to social services, and stop all support for socially and environmentally destructive projects. Joanne Carter, the legislative director of Results, is content that the World Bank IMF is reviewing the demands.
All of these demands at some level are in discussion or on the table, so all of these issues have been raised. I think that the World Bank would acknowledge that all of these issues are real issues that have to be addressed, and they may not agree with every point of what we put forward, but I think that they really have agreed that these issues are problems and they're issues that have to be addressed, and that's a first step.
With only a month before the September 29th and 30th World Bank IMF meetings in D.C., there is now a World Bank bonds boycott in effect, with participants including 7 major cities, 12 unions, 7 religious institutions, and 10 investment firms. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Zach Padorf.
And finally, members of a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender civil rights group are going on trial tomorrow for voicing their opinion at a legislative public hearing in Illinois. Danielle Chenoweth has this report from the Urbana Indy Media Center.
5 gay rights activists who were arrested in the Illinois Capitol May 9th are scheduled for trial this Wednesday on the charge of criminal trespass to state-supported land. On May 9th, members of the organization, the 85% Coalition, attended a public hearing before the Senate Executive Committee concerning a bill to amend the Illinois Human Rights Act to include sexual orientation and gender identity. The bill passed the House in April, but is stalled in the Senate. During the public hearing, the bill was pulled from debate, at which point activists marched to the front of the hearing room, faced the committee, and chanted, "No, no, we won't go until we have equality, and we're your daughters, we're your sons, pass House Bill 101. Five were arrested and face a maximum penalty of 364 days in jail and a $2,500 fine. Gay rights activists have vowed to continue to protest until they have equal rights in the state of Illinois. This is Danielle Shenowitz of the Urbana Independent Media Center for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The vice is tightening in Beit Jala after Israeli troops occupied almost the whole of the Palestinian-controlled city. Israel has been using U.S.-made Apache helicopters and F-16 fighter jets along with U.S.-made tanks and armed personnel carriers. Raphael Kraft is in Beit Jala and files this report.
Beit Jala is a Christian Palestinian town as one can represent it in the Western imagination. Its stones are centenarian, white and polished by the sun. Its streets are narrow and steep. Bethlehem is very near. The threat had been floating in the air for 2 weeks. "A single shoot on Gilo from Beit Jala and we invade," said Benjamin Ben Eliezer, the Israeli Ministry of Defense, referring to the Jewish colony facing the Palestinian town. The assassination by Israeli yesterday of Abu Ali Mustafa, the head of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, has put an end to the ultimatum. Palestinians under shock started again to shoot at Gilo yesterday. At 1 o'clock this morning, Israeli soldiers and tanks entered the old city of Beit Jala. Since then, the street fightings haven't stopped in intensity. At the corner of an alley, some fanciful Palestinian fighters shoot at the Israeli tank facing them. The ballet of the US-made F-16 fighters and Apache helicopters has not ceased since this morning. It maintains the fear of the Palestinian civilians hidden away in the safest corners of their homes. The streets are empty. The occupied part of Beit Jala is under curfew. At 8 o'clock tonight, one Palestinian policeman was killed and more than 20 Palestinians were wounded. Nazrin Kunkar, 25 years old, lives in Beit Jala.
"We know that what they say is they are staying here only for a period of time and they will leave. But we believe it's going to be the opposite. Like, they will stay here so that they can secure Gilo settlement, which they don't consider it as a settlement, but a part of Jerusalem."
Since the invasion this morning, a group of Israeli soldiers protected by a tank has been occupying the Lutheran Church of Beit Jala, an orphanage sheltering some 45 children aged from 6 to 16 years old. A delegation of the Lutheran Church in the Middle East managed to go by the Israeli lines to bring food supplies to the children. At its head, the Bishop Muni Bounam is indignant.
"We have already made contacts even with the French government and with the Americans and with the Germans. I think this is not accepted. Church property has to be protected because our property has never been used for any military action. It has always been, you know, a peaceful place to create common understanding between Muslim Jews and Christians."
The Israeli soldiers posted snipers at the windows and in the church tower. The presence of the children in the middle of the Israeli soldiers is seen by Palestinians as the best human shield the Israeli army could get in occupying Beit Jala. A small group of peace activists visited the children as well. After the meeting, they sat in front of an Israeli tank trying to engage a conversation with Israeli soldiers inside.
"How do you feel being positioned in front of an orphanage where you have 45 kids and they're scared to death?" "Excuse me? What is that supposed to mean? I don't understand sign language." "Are you going to leave? I'll move if you're going to leave."
The sit-in has rapidly been cut short by the atmosphere of war that has come over in Beit Jala. Since dawn, the vice draws closer as the Israelis are now in control of most of the old city. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Beit Jala.
At the Hague War Crimes Tribunal in the Netherlands, a top Bosnian Serb leader charged with genocide and crimes against humanity was denied a request to attend a memorial service in Bosnia for his father, who died last month. The move comes just days before the next appearance of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic at the tribunal. From The Hague, for Free Speech Radio News, Jeremy Scahill reports.
Momcilo Krajcnik, the former speaker of the Bosnian parliament and top aide to Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, showed no emotion today as Judge Richard May told him he would not be going to Republika Srpska to attend a Serbian Orthodox service for his deceased father.
Given the seriousness of this case, the trial chamber, the majority of the trial chamber, is therefore not satisfied that he would return and appear for trial if he were released. For those reasons, the application is dismissed.
Judge May is the same judge presiding over the case of Slobodan Milosevic. The former Yugoslav president will appear before the judge on Thursday here at the Hague Tribunal. Since his last appearance, Milosevic has filed a motion asking that the case against him be thrown out on grounds that the court has no jurisdiction over him, that it's an illegal court, and that his extradition to the Hague Tribunal was in contravention of both Yugoslav and international law. With his hearing just days away, observers are anticipating another defiant appearance by the former Yugoslav leader. Nenad Stefanovic is a columnist for the news magazine Vreme, based in Belgrade.
He will continue in the same direction, totally trying to ignore this court, to say once again that this tribunal has no legal basis and violates fundamental principles of international law.
There's a lot happening here in The Hague this week. A Dutch judge is to rule on Friday whether a case brought by lawyers supporting Milosevic can go forward. The lawyers argue that The Hague is an illegal and political court, concerned only with selective justice. They charge NATO leaders are the true criminals for their 1999 bombing of Yugoslavia, a bombing that killed scores of civilians and saw civilian infrastructure bombed. Officials at The Hague reject these statements and defend what they call The Hague's impartiality. Tribunal spokesperson Jim Landale.
This is an independent tribunal, and it will continue to be an independent tribunal. And with particular reference to the trial of Slobodan Milosevic, he will have the opportunity to challenge the prosecution's case at every step of the procedure. So it's an independent court.
As Milosevic's case slowly makes its way to trial, there is currently controversial legislation making its way through the U.S. Congress, legislation that would seek to threaten or punish countries that support the establishment of an international criminal court that would have jurisdiction over U.S. officials and soldiers. One of the most shocking provisions of the legislation calls for U.S. military intervention to rescue American citizens arrested abroad on charges of war crimes. Some in Europe are already calling it the Hague Invasion Act. It would also seek to ban those countries that ratify the ICC from receiving U.S. aid or assistance. According to Liliana Smilovic, an expert on U.S.-Yugoslav affairs, that would also include Yugoslavia.
I find it very ironic that Yugoslavia, which extradited its former president, Slobodan Milosevic, in order to receive $1 billion in assistance, may soon find itself cut off from any American assistance because it has ratified the International Criminal Tribunal.
Supporters of Milosevic are planning a demonstration tomorrow in nearby Amsterdam. Among those expected to attend is former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jeremy Scahill at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal in the Netherlands.
Roadless areas make up a third of our nation's national forests, and the Bush administration is in the middle of a new 60-day public comment period on how to manage those areas. Last year, the Clinton administration came up with a management plan after 2 years of comment taking, 1.6 million public comments taken, and 600 public meetings held. Clinton signed the resulting policy just days before he left office. The state of Idaho then sued, and federal judge Edward Lodge prevented the rule from taking effect, saying that the public comment period had been inadequate. Now, environmentalists are wondering if the new, less well-publicized public comment period is the beginning of the end for the protection of this nation's roadless areas. Lee Robartes has more from Idaho.
In the city of Lewiston, Idaho, the Potlatch Corporation operates a 2,000-person mill which produces 90% of the grocery store brand tissue products sold in the West and enough wood to build 10,000 average-sized homes a year. In his office at the mill, communications director Frank Carroll says Potlatch quit buying timber directly off federal lands several years ago because they say the supply was unreliable.
A one-size-fits-all roadless policy rammed down our throats will not stand through the remainder of this year.
Carroll lambasted the upper-level Forest Service managers who worked under Clinton, who he says were not forest professionals.
They believed that they could cobble together some kind of popularity contest, and that 135,000 or whatever it was postcards from their dear friends in the environmental community would give them the cover they needed to enact bad policy. That's not going to happen this time. The U.S. Forest Service knows that the roadless policy is indefensible, that clearly there are places that need to be unroaded and protected, but clearly there are other places that need roads in order to affect management. And when I say management, I mean so that we end up with living, breathing forests and communities that are not burning down in wildfires.
Asking 10 questions on its Forest Service website, the Bush administration wants the public to consider making roadless area policy decisions on a forest-by-forest basis. Mike Peterson of the Lands Council in Spokane, Washington, believes the Bush administration is using the new, lesser-known public comment period to bury the plan.
You know, we've got dozens of national forests with roadless areas on them. Some of those have just had recent plans, so it really doesn't make a lot of sense to start off getting these dozens of forests going on a whole new administrative process when this one clearly reflected the will of the American public.
Peterson believes the administration is expecting to get a lot less comments this time because people have already expressed their opinions and there wasn't a lot of opposition last time. That's a feeling shared by Matthew Kaler of Missoula, Montana's Native Forest Protection Alliance.
We basically feel as if they're orchestrating this comment period to basically generate public comments that they feel will lend some validation to how they want to manage roadless areas, which they clearly want to manage roadless areas by allowing logging, road building, oil and gas development, mining, and grazing.
Gary McFarlane is with Friends of the Clearwater. He says the forests his group seeks to protect, the Nez Perce and Clearwater National Forests in north-central Idaho, are typically thought of as the big wild.
It's part of the largest ecosystem left in the lower 48 states that's largely intact. These forests have everything from typical northern Rockies flora and fauna, salmon, bull trout, wolves, down to species more indicative of the coastal range like western red cedar.
McFarland says even the roadless rule signed by Clinton had loopholes, leaving some management decisions up to local forest managers.
The loopholes are they allow logging as long as you don't build roads, helicopter logging, for example, or even driving vehicles on non-roads, just cross-country. And if you drive enough vehicles, eventually it will become a road, but that's a loophole. It does not protect these areas from off-road vehicle use. It does not protect them from mining, and it does not protect them from new grazing permits. So there are quite a few loopholes, although it is better than the status quo.
McFarland says a roadless plan would have an especially big impact on the 1.5 million official roadless acres on the Nez Perce and Clearwater forests because of the influence of the recreation industry.
The recreation industry we're talking about here are the big, large corporations and the motorized vehicle industry. They want to turn what are narrow foot trails into wide trails available for these four-wheeled all-terrain vehicles, these off-road vehicles. So that can be negative and have profound impacts on wildlife and water quality as well.
The Idaho-based Blue Ribbon Coalition is the largest nationwide motorized recreation group in the country. Its webpage features numerous ads for snowmobiles, all-terrain vehicles, and dirt bikes. Adina Cook, public lands director for the group, says the Clinton plan failed to take into account roads and off-road vehicle trails that didn't show up on maps.
And while motorized recreation was allowed under the Clinton-Dombeck plan, you know, there wouldn't have been any immediate closures. We felt very threatened by it. And we felt that roads that weren't adequately inventoried would be immediately closed and could not be maintained. In fact, that's what it said. So that's not a conjecture, that's a given. But we also felt that trails now open to motorized recreation would be under increasing pressure to be closed.
The comments period ends Monday, September 10th. Again, Mike Peterson of the Lands Council.
What we haven't seen yet from the Bush administration is that we don't know, are they going to hold public meetings? You know, are they going to have hearings? We don't have any indication of that.
Peterson says that would happen if Bush intends to follow processes set out in the National Environmental Policy Act. Comments can be sent through the U.S. Forest Service website. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Moscow, Idaho.
The U.S. government has granted a Texas company a patent on three varieties of basmati rice, and officials as well as activists in India are outraged. They say the strains of rice in question were developed over generations by Indian farmers and didn't originate with the company Ricetech's genetic experiments. On the growing controversy, Mary O'Grady reports from Austin.
On August 14th, Ricetech, a company based in Alvin, Texas, obtained a patent for its three varieties of basmati rice. Legal challenges had reduced the number of claims accepted by the U.S. Patent Office for Ricetech's varieties of the rice, which is native to the Indian subcontinent. Some Indian politicians and international development groups are protesting the issuance of the patent. Bruce Hicks is Ricetech's spokesman.
Ricetech spent 10 years developing a very high-quality basmati rice that can be grown in the United States. So it sought the patent, got the patent, to protect those three varieties. That's all it wanted to do, was protect its varieties from its competitors in the United States. We used the word basmati very generically in the title of the patent. So the title was Basmati Rice Lines and Grains. But because many folks in India and elsewhere don't understand U.S. patent law, which is not surprising, they somehow took the belief that we had patented the name basmati, that we were now in control of all basmati rice grown or imported into the United States, that we were going to be charging duties to farmers just to grow the rice back in India, and on and on and on. All kinds of just ludicrous and outlandish things.
Bruce Hicks, spokesman for Ricetech, the Texas agricultural company which has obtained a U.S. patent for three varieties of basmati rice. Alex Widjaratna is the food rights campaigner for ActionAid, an international development agency based in London. I asked him what Ricetech had to gain by patenting their varieties of rice.
Ownership and control of those particular varieties of basmati, you know, it's market ownership, essentially. Essentially, the Indians and the subcontinentals are saying basmati can only be grown on the subcontinent. And so they see a loss of export markets if they're competing with U.S. grown. But it's also the issue of loss of cultural heritage as well, that something that has been developed by farmers in India for generations is then privatized. This is the context that the patent is coming from. Basically, the World Trade Organization is pushing through a patenting regime which is strongest in the U.S. throughout the developing world, and this is known as the TRIPS Agreement. It stipulates that the plants, crops, and their genes can be patented and should be instituted into national law throughout the world. So this is very much to do with globalization, and the developing world is saying that they don't want their plants and crops to be patented. They don't want it to be privatized, because obviously the developing world is the seat of 90% of all biological wealth, and 97% of all patents are coming from the north, are coming from the rich country.
Alex Widjaratna of ActionAid. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mary O'Grady in Austin, Texas.
The state of New Mexico has renewed a 5-year permit to the Salt River Project out of Phoenix, Arizona. The permit lets Salt River strip mine coal in western New Mexico. Now the members of the Zuni Pueblo are appealing the permit, saying the mine could harm their sacred areas. The deal awaits final approval from the U.S. Interior Department. Which way is it likely to go? For Free Speech Radio News, Lolita Roybal has the story.
The state's decision comes after 26 years of protest by Zuni Pueblo of western New Mexico
Mexico, who say the mine could dry up Zuni Salt Lake. Zuni Pueblo Governor Malcolm Bawakari says the lake is sacred to many Pueblo peoples.
It is just as salty as the ocean. This is the crater that you see over here. When you go in here, you can't drown. It is so buoyant that you can actually float in there. When you come out and you dry off, you become pure white.
Although the coal mine is 12 miles away from the lake and not on the Zuni Reservation, Governor Bawakati says many experts agree that coal mining might dry up the 4-foot-deep lake. In addition, Bawakati says the coal mining could unearth the remains of Zuni ancestors.
If there is any way to avoid the thousands of human remains that will be unearthed, we'd like to be there. I think those are reasonable requests. It'll be similar to if the Zuni tribe declared Arlington Cemetery as a coal mine. And if we wanted to bulldoze that, I'm sure that you're going to see a national outcry.
Co-program manager of the state's Mining and Minerals Division, Jim O'Hara, believes the permit should be granted regardless of sacredness issues. He says state regulations only require a company to meet environmental standards, although the public can comment.
Our mandate is to review a permit based on how it would comply with the federal and state laws. It's not to take a vote and decide, you know, how many people like it or how many people don't. If the project was located on tribal lands, I would say the tribe, the owner of the property in that case, would have every right to veto.
Company officials say the coal mine complies with the tribe's wishes, but Zuni Pueblo and the many other tribes that support them are not satisfied. Bawakati says if it were up to him, there would be no mine. The issue is one of many current debates in New Mexico over whether the U.S. government should be required to respect areas sacred to Native Americans. Ongoing struggles include a proposed road through Petroglyph National Monument near Albuquerque and the situation of Los Alamos National Laboratories in the sacred Jemez Mountains. According to the Indigenous Mining Campaign Project, which is a joint effort between the Indigenous Environmental Network and Project Underground, Native peoples are unequally impacted by mining. The majority of U.S. mines are located on or near reservations. In addition, the project cites the recent U.S. toxic release inventory, which found that in the last 2 years, mining released the highest levels of toxins of all other industries. They call desecration of these sites across the country environmental racism. The Salt River Project intentionally preys on Indian peoples, according to Bawakati. He says they wouldn't think of mining near other areas because they know farmers would protest it. Bawakati says he at least wants reassurance before mining starts that the lake will not be affected. The Salt River Project's Bob Barnard says the lake simply won't dry up.
I don't think you'll find, if you look at the hydrologic reports very carefully, that there is anyone that said for certain that the lake will dry up.
But according to Zuni Governor Bawakati, after 26 years, the state finally acknowledges the possibility that an aquifer connects the mining site and the lake.
They're saying, based on new information, which the Zuni tribe has been arguing for these past years, finally, at the 11th hour, a government-to-government, face-to-face meeting with Douglas Bland, the cumulative hydrological impact area will include the Zuni Salt Lake.
However, the state's Jim O'Hara says there are only theories as to what will happen either way. So although the state concedes the possibility of dry up, they granted the permit. The tribe is appealing it. The renewal does require the company to perform a pump test before mining. Now the permit awaits Secretary of the Interior Gail Norton's approval. Zuni Governor Bawakati.
If they sign off on the permit application package, which is related to the federal lands area, the Zuni tribe will have no recourse but to file a suit against the federal government saying that there's a major breach of trust and hopefully lock this in up. We don't like to go there, but that's an option we have to look at.
In New Mexico, I'm Lolita Roival for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Laura Flanders. Please tune in again tomorrow.